So, in a manner of speaking, all these various ways we have of addressing our bodies and minds to the practice are also like the lid. If we're going to be able to heat water for tea, that is probably indispensable. In other words, there has to be a certain way of doing things that everyone can enter into, and in so doing, forget about our individual predilections, which might inspire us to do something else, depending on the day or how we're feeling. But since that's mostly how we live our lives, is in response to our preferences and predilections, it's very useful to have a way of entering the world where those can be set aside, not disrespected, but more like forgotten about. Just never mind that way. This is how we're doing things now. This becomes a sort of lid for our practice so that we can heat water for tea. And the tea, so to speak, is the real point. To be able to serve tea to everyone. That's the real point. But if you don't have a pot and the pot doesn't have a lid, it can be pretty difficult. Not that it's not there, but people are going to have trouble seeing it and feeling like, oh yeah, there's actually something. There's something here. And then, well, I don't know about you, but that can get kind of discouraging. When I was still a kid, I felt rather oppressed by having the only kind of spirituality I was introduced to be sort of a rote performance involving, in particular, a certain set of beliefs, which if you did not ascribe to, you were kind of not part of the gang. And I was very hungry for some way of relating to the world that could transform the sort of habitual way of seeing things. Because I had a sense that there was a, I don't know what, a wider horizon somewhere. What I was experiencing as the, you know, a rather low ceiling, that was not the whole story. So, as some of you know, I went to speak to the some of the senior members of the monastic community that was running the boarding school where I was deposited by my parents. To my consternation, but anyway, there I was. And these were Benedictine monks, European Benedictine monks. So I thought, well, great, they're going to know. So I went to ask them about, okay, it's all very well. These, I didn't use the term conventional pieties, but that's what I was thinking. They probably would have slapped me for that. So I didn't say that. I just said, you know, this, it's all very well, the stuff that I had been doing since I was, you know, a little kid. That's all very well, but I think there must be something else. And I said, indeed, there's a whole amazing tradition of Christian contemplative life, so let's do that. And I was told, oh, that's not for you, Sonny. And, you know, if you're a fairly tightly wound 14-year-old, that's not what you want to hear. You want to have somebody telling you, that's not for you, Sonny. So I quite furiously announced that I was going to go look for another religion, which made me an outlaw in my boarding school. I was fine. I didn't mind that much. And I eventually wound up with Buddhism because it looked like, oh, you can actually do Buddhism. You can actually do something. You can actually experience your life in a different way than you grew up being told was, oh, it's just, it's just how things are, it's the usual way. Meanwhile, there are these great mystics who seem to have found a new way of looking at things. And even in Buddhism, of course, there is some tendency to leave this kind of cultivation of genuine insight into reality, which after all was the heart of Buddha's message, to leave that to others, leave that to professionals. And the rest of us, we support that effort and make offerings and so forth, but that kind of cultivating, penetrating insight, that's for the professionals. So no sooner does Buddha Dharma come to the West than you find that people are really into, they want that professional stuff. People want to learn how to cultivate insight into accurate reality. Not just making offerings and, supporting the professionals. And this is still a distinct difference between Buddha Dharma as it's understood in the West and in Asia, where that distinction between the professionals who are doing that kind of cultivation, that's fine for them. The rest of us, we have our ordinary lives as householders, etc. And that really didn't catch on so much in the West. It certainly wasn't what I was interested in. And when, for instance, certain figures like, Suzuki Roshi and Trungpa Rinpoche came upon the scene and actually were willing to talk about that stuff, what the professionals do, I was on cloud nine, at least for a while. Then I discovered, no, it's not so easy, this cultivating stuff. And you read certain books, you get the impression that, wow, man, just one weekend is enough, and you're gonna be transported. And it's like I used to think that, and then I realized actually, no, that's probably not true. And people who offer that are not to be trusted. So, as my teacher likes to say, he likes to quote the Book of Serenity that says somewhere, everyone wants to talk about the achievement that crowns the age. No one wants to talk about 10,000 sweating horses. So,
what do they want to talk about? The achievement
that crowns the age.
Yeah.
Yes, right. But never mind the sweating horses. And yet, when you start to practice, you discover, oh man, there's some sweating horses involved here, and that's me. It's not so easy. On the other hand, some part of me wants to do that. Keeps coming back to that over and over again. When the first time we practice sitting in stillness, there's already some response. And that response keeps drawing us back again and again, even if we're disgusted with it, which does happen, let's face it. Sometimes practice can look very discouraging, and if we haven't yet learned that, that's not a problem, that's just part of the landscape. Sometimes people will get discouraged, and if they don't have the teacher to talk to about that, they can be turned off to Buddha Dharma. And of course, in Buddhism, that is a great shame and something to be avoided at all possible. So, and then people like Dogen also taught us about, well, how do we talk about this that we're doing? There has to be a way to talk with each other about it and for our teachers to talk to us. And this, of course, became the collection known as the Treasury of the True Dharma Eye and various other expressions of the, we might call it the Chan or Zen dispensation, it's sometimes called, which is just another way of talking about Buddha Dharma, but always returns to the fact that Shakyamuni Buddha presented as the panacea for human suffering the accurate view of reality. This, of course, means that on some level and at some point, the so-called three marks of existence become kind of inarguable. And those are, anybody know the three marks?
Dukkha?
Yes, that's one. That's usually the first one that everyone knows about. Everyone knows about dukkha. Dukkha and anicca, yes, impermanence. And the last one is anatman, right? So in Sanskrit, dukkha, anicca, and anatman. And you know, this is one way of summing up Buddha's insight into reality, and it's a little bit, it has a slightly bitter taste, let's say. So, the idea of practice is that any sentient being with a functioning body-mind can cultivate the accurate view of reality, which will run against who knows how many eons, how many kalpas of the karma of wrong view, resulting in rebirth over and over and over again. So there's a lot of current pushing the other way. And usually all we have to do is, yeah, just try sitting still for a few minutes if you want to experience what that current is, which is constantly trying to get us to move, you know, go do something more fun. Never mind this. This is not necessary. And this current is can be met by that aspect of the sentient being that is still and silent and always present. And the heart of our Zazen practice, that's the support of our Zazen practice. And you could say that practice is a way of inviting that to come forward, so to speak. So I often remind myself and others that we're not trying to impose stillness on this body mind. We're trying to invite what is already profoundly still to come forward. So we make that invitation when we sit down and compose ourselves. And especially in Soto Zen, you know, there's no particular exercise. So we have this tradition of just sitting, which is the tradition of allowing this this profound aspect of our body mind to manifest. It has elsewhere been called the still small voice, and that's appropriate. It's not dramatic, and it is easily overlooked. So often we have to come back to that again and again in order to appreciate that it's something genuine. There's something actually there. And there are millions of words written about it. And this is all that Dogen talked about in has many years of teaching. A while ago, I was at the annual conference of the Association of Soto Zen Buddhists in Los Angeles, and I didn't go this past year, but the year before, we welcomed Carl Bielefeld, who was the kind of the main figure in arranging for the what is now the kind of the most excellent, thorough translation of Dogen's masterwork, Shobo Genzo. And the eight-volume translation, which is just so beautiful, was presented to us, and we were invited to ask questions. And so I popped up and I said to Professor Bielefeld, said, "And I don't think that I don't find Dogen all that difficult to understand and appreciate, as long as I am aware that he's basically always talking about Zazen." And Professor Bielefeld did not agree. He said, "Well, no, what about all those koans? Isn't that different?" And I said, "No." Unfortunately, we didn't have a chance to pursue that because there were other questions. But what I should have said was, Dogen's always talking either about Zazen or from Zazen. And when you understand that, what he says is not that complicated. You know, it's resonant and amazing and inspiring, but it's not all that, "Oh, what is he talking about? I can't figure this out. This is too hard." He's speaking to that same what has been called the one who is not busy, for instance. The one who already understands. That one always hears that voice and responds. So when we hear Dharma talks or we read sutras or whatnot, that one is always hearing and responding. And if we don't immediately appreciate that, well, one day. So, do we do prostrations now, or, how do we dress, and do we abandon the ancient and wonderful practice of burning incense and replace it with floral items, or do we do something else? This is all part of the lid, right? This will contain the heat of the practice, which is boiling the water from which we can make tea to share with everybody. But again, if you don't have the lid, all your water everything can turn to steam and evaporate. So the lid is important. And the lid might look any of a million different ways, but it's important to have one. Last Saturday, I gave a talk at my place, and there were fewer in the audience than there are now. So, but I started by telling people, when I give a talk, I am speaking to the one who already understands. And it took me quite a while to appreciate that that's what my teacher was doing. But there is such a one, and I don't mean one of you all. Mrs. Hiroshi said something very similar. I guess one of his talks or something, maybe during Sesshin. And he said, I think probably, speaking to the Zendo when people were sitting, he said, how did he put it? Something like, uh, Someone has already come to enlightenment and doesn't know it yet. Mm-hmm. And for many years, I wandered around thinking, oh, who was that? Who do you mean? Was it so-and-so? Or no, it must have been that guy, you know, or that gal or somebody. But that's not what he meant. It took me a long time to appreciate he was talking about everybody. And this is, you know, this is an important point. There is someone who has come to enlightenment and doesn't know it yet. And maybe that's all right. Maybe you don't need to know it. In fact, maybe it's better if they don't. We have this whole thing, in particularly in Soto Zen, in Shaodong lineage, there's this taboo against speaking the name of the emperor. You don't talk about that stuff. It's vulgar and misleading, so we don't say that. We don't prance around saying, oh, someone got enlightened, look at that, congratulations. And, you know. There are places where someone has, experienced a successful retreat, let's call it that, they get presented with a raksu. And I remember the first time I heard about it, I thought, that's wrong, man, don't do that. You know, oh, look, they're wearing raksus, oh, that's really cool, I wish I could. And, you know, not everyone's nervous system and body mind is going to respond the same way to practice. So what if you're one of those people who, that's not how you vibrate? Well, you'll never get a raksu, haha. You know, that's terrible. It's a terrible way to treat people. And I've known some people who have practiced vigorously for years and years and still think that, oh no, I'm not enlightened, you know, I don't get it. You know, this is terrible. Their teacher should whack them and say, stop thinking like that. And my own teacher, he didn't whack me, at least not that time. Actually, he never did, now that I think of it. But he did say, there I was in Dogasan complaining yet again about, you know, missing the achievement that crowned the age, basically. Where's my achievement that crowns the age? And he said, maybe it's time you dropped that. He was right. So I did. And all of a sudden, things felt spacious to me. So, anyway, I don't want to keep you too long. But these are things that have been rattling around in what's left of my mind these days. But maybe you have some question or comment. Yes.
Thank you very much. So it's not inviting one who is the one who is already present, the silent, still one. And there is a theme that repeated in Zen about non-striving. Mm-hmm. At the same time, where there's quite a bit of scripture to the effect of releasing thoughts.
Of what?
Releasing thought.
Releasing thought?
Releasing thought. Stopping thought.
Not to stopping. Mm-hmm. Be very careful. But let's say releasing for now. Do you want to? Is that okay?
It's okay with me.
Okay, all right.
Do not administer pros and cons. Do not think bad or good. Mm-hmm. Stop all. Stop. I think the word is stop. All action.
All movements of the conscious mind.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah.
So. And there's a lot of similar verbiage.
Yes. This is the lid. But anyway, go ahead.
Well, maybe you've just answered my question.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. So, if Dogen were present, we might ask him or them or her, what did you mean by cease all the movements of the conscious mind? Like, does anybody do that who's not dead? It's like, yeah, well, possibly. But he wasn't talking about that sort of yogic state of kaivalyam, which supposedly there's the spiritual equivalent of absolute zero. Like, that's not what he's talking about. He never talks about that. So he must have meant something else. And I think what he meant was more like what you meant by release. So in a sense, cease just means let it go. Do not pursue, do not entertain, do not banish, let it go. And it's not usually clear immediately to people what that means. Hence, some sweating horses. And it's very common, certainly was for me, for people to spend some time thinking, now I got it, that's what they meant, oh, here we go. And then like third day into session, it's like, oh no, that's not what they meant. Oh, this is terrible. You know, it's like, okay, so back to the drawing board. Let it go. And the one who is not busy comes forward. Whether we say, oh, there you are, in fact, probably better if you don't, just let that person be. The one who already understands, the one who is already enlightened and doesn't know it yet, let that one be. And our practice is an elaborate invitation to that one to come forward and be, so to speak, honored quietly. Vows, offerings, etc.
That one,
right. Yes.
So just to, oh yeah, thank you. Thank you for your talk, Reverend Myo. To continue on just the same theme, mm-hmm. It seems to me, you know, after practicing for a while, it's perhaps easier to see what to let go while you're sitting on the cushion than in your
running
everyday.
Around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. But the practice does allow that cultivation, I think, so that whereas you would never have noticed what to let go of before.
Yeah, you probably know, not.
Mm-hmm. Right, but now, sometimes it's a little late.
Yes.
You know, right?
Sometimes it is. That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But,
The onrushing force of karma is very strong. Yeah. So to become acquainted with the, I don't know, the body mind that is unmoved by that onrushing current is very helpful.
And there are occasions when, in your everyday life, you notice this, you realize, yeah, no one's doing this to me.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's just, yeah, it's imagine, you know, imaginary.
Right.
So it makes it easier to let it go when you realize it's just yourself doing, yeah, it to yourself.
Yeah. David Chadwick, in one of his Kuke.com posts the other day, quoted Suzuki Roshi saying something very similar, something like, once you realize or understand that you have created suffering for yourself, he said, that works pretty well. That will be very helpful, he said, just to realize, oh, I just made some problem. I just made some mess for me and maybe for some others too. He said, already you have pulled yourself out of that current and you're no longer doing that. So this is very helpful. So he said, he encouraged people to do that practice, even though it doesn't seem like much, maybe, but it's very important. Overall, of course, he described our practice as making only a little difference, but a little difference that's really important. And boy, was he right, I would say.
Thank you. I'm reading Chadwick's new book now.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Of course.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I can ask this question clearly, but I'll try, and it's continuing of the previous questions. Mm-hmm. Is there a difference in that release between that trying, or maybe not trying, but that releasing on the cushion versus releasing off the cushion? And I'll, as an example, when I'm sitting, like tonight, you know, my legs falling asleep and I'm trying, you know, I don't want to fall over when I stand up. And mm-hmm. so I might be adjusting and, you know, my mind will start thinking about that on the cushion. And then off the cushion, I'm thinking about how can I adjust my pillow, you know, next time I sit, or how can I adjust my cushion? Maybe I need something else. Is it? Uh-huh. Yeah. See, I don't know if it's clear, but.
Well, you know, everybody has these sorts of preoccupations, including me. You know, I spent many, many years trying to finesse my practice. You know, it's like, well, this can't be it. So maybe I can improve it by tweaking that, you know, or maybe this. And that went on for quite a while. And I wasn't able to appreciate that when we are taught, just sit. That's what they meant. That's what they mean. And all that other stuff, it's like, let it go. There is some shape to it. There is a lid. You know, it's going to be much, much easier if we sit something like this, you know, not exactly like this, but, you know, whether it's a chair or maybe we have to lie down, but some actual way rather than just sort of whatever, sort of random. Now, maybe that would work too, but it's going to be a long time before we appreciate it. So it'll be better to have a kind of a lid. But we're sort of taught that, you know, this lid is very simple. This lid is just sit, clunk. There it is. You're doing it. The one who is not busy is deeply satisfied. So don't worry. So this is the theme over and over again in our practice. And again, it's only a little difference, but boy, does it matter. It really does.
I have a question. Thank you very much. I really enjoyed listening.
Oh, I beg your pardon.
Let them know they need to start.
I see.
Is my voice audible?
Yes.
Okay. So, you know, you said you are talking to the one who understands. And that reminded me, like Eckhart Tolle, I was using, like, you know, he says a portal of presence or something, like body awareness. And sometime I'll be listening to audiobook, just being aware of the body. And then thoughts will not be there. And I didn't understand. I mean, I understood, but I was like doubting myself. Am I fooling myself? Is this way? Am I understanding? Because thoughts were not there. I just wanted your input. Like, let's say I'm listening to audiobook or I'm listening to you with the body awareness and thoughts are not there. So mm-hmm. I guess the one who understands is listening. The one who really needs to know or who really matters is still listening.
Is still listening and understands, yes. So as far as the doubts are concerned, let them go. Also, you don't need to, you know, we should be a little cautious about getting stuck somewhere like, oh, now I understand. Oh, this is great. It's like, that's not very helpful either. But please trust that aspect of your own body-mind that is content to be there in stillness with no particular thoughts, just listening. That is genuine.
Yes. Thank you.
Hello. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. I really like the, I don't know if it's a metaphor or analogy or what, but the pot and the lid. Mm-hmm. And I've always sort of had a little bit of resistance to a lot of the forms, yeah. Right? Mm-hmm. And I've come to appreciate them much more than I did a few years ago. I also just really appreciate this thing about the small, still voice within, because a lot of times what I've found is that just sitting, like tonight, there's a point in the sitting with everyone when suddenly the quiet becomes so intense. Mm-hmm. And I'm just really appreciating all that and appreciating mm-hmm. your talk so much. It's very heartfelt, and it just really resonated. Mm-hmm. So thank you.
Sure. You remind me of being at Green Gulch Farm with my teacher, and of course my teacher is now the Pure Land of retirement. So he's not at Green Gulch anymore, which is too bad. But back in the day, we'd have these classes like once a week, and the Wheelwright Center would be full of people in standing room, you know. And I don't remember, it was probably Book of Serenity or some such class. And I don't remember which story he was talking about, but he just sort of stopped. He said, "Do you feel that?" And the whole room was dead silent. And I went, "Yeah, this happens." And there's no special talent. There's no special gift. It just happens. And everyone, I felt like, was going, "Yeah, whatever that is, I don't know what it is, but yeah." And everyone was hearing that voice on some level, that still small voice. It was quite an impressive moment. And he didn't take any credit for it. He just said, "There it is." Yes.
So I've been wanting to ask this question for some time, mm-hmm. and I'm not really even sure if I should be asking this question, if it's a question that should be, if I should even ask the question to myself. But when I'm meditating, I'm asking this to myself. I'm beginning to feel a sense that the inner activity and the outer activity that I'm sensing, like, you know, thoughts, feelings, inner sensations, and then outer sounds, there's really not... there's not really a difference between them.
Correct.
They're all part of the same.
Well, there's some difference, but yes, basically.
But then the question I'm asking myself is, then is it all outside of me, or is it all inside of me?
Do you know that poem, that Wang Wei poem that Reb likes? In my middle years, I've become rather fond of the Wei. And there's a meditation instruction in there where the poet, I think it's Wang Wei, says, "Follow the stream to the source. Sit there and watch for the moment that the clouds pile up." And he's talking exactly about sitting there, and the clouds are basically all those phenomena, inner, outer, and watch how we label them. Like, "Oh, that's me, That's outside. This is something else. This is my habitual mind or whatever it is. All that labeling, those are clouds. And basically, we take our seat at the source, let all of that come up and manifest, and just watch those, watch the labeling, but don't fall into it. So don't decide that's out there, that's in here. That's perfectly natural, but don't, you don't have to subscribe to that. Just watch. That's all you have to do. And you're actually right. It is kind of like it's neither inside nor outside. And it's both. So that distinction is part of the activity of the sentient being's mind. That's outside, that's inside. When actually no, it's just one thing arising over and over again. Why? Because there's only one source. That's the same for everyone. And Wang Wei is saying, take your seat there and just watch. So I don't know if that speaks constructively to your question, but that's my response anyway. So that's a great poem, by the way. If we haven't studied that already, let's make a copy so everyone can read it. It's quite beautiful. How does it end? Something like, I might meet a woodsman, and we talk and laugh, and I forget about going home.
Yeah. You've referenced that poem before.
I'm sure I have.
What's the name?
Yeah. The poet's Wang Wei. I don't know if it has a title, but it's the one that starts, in my middle years, I have become rather fond of the Wei.
Right when you were talking in your talk about the still small voice, and maybe it was just a bit of kind of a throwaway thing. You said
probably
when it comes, it's not dramatic. You said, mm-hmm. And I said, oh yes, it is.
Okay,
but you know, then the problem is that getting caught by the drama or the thrill or the and then the attendant problem of wishing you could get back to there.
And does it have to have the same taste all the time? No. That's exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Don't get caught in thinking like, wow, yesterday during session, oh man, that was so great. And it's like, and now I'm going to do that again. It's like, no, you're not.
Right. No. You never, never, ever.
Don't bother.
You never get back there. Mm-hmm.